Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Big decisions on voting are waiting in the wings in North Carolina. The U.S. Supreme Court may have decided that they wouldn't get involved in the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts. But a lower court may soon decide whether partisan gerrymanders fly in the face of the state constitution when it comes to legislative districts. And that decision, whatever it is, may have long-lasting implications because of the upcoming 2020 census. Meanwhile, evidence of Russian interference in the last presidential election and worries about future interference has the state elections board taking a fresh look at how we vote, and their decision will impact next year's presidential election process. So we're going to take a close look at both this hour. We're joined by Melissa Bowden, courts and law reporter for NC Policy Watch. She joins us via Skype this morning. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Will Duran is a politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Nice talking with you.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Melissa, as I mentioned, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to rule on the constitutionality of North Carolina's partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts because they said the federal judiciary has no role to play in the extreme partisan gerrymandering cases that have come before it. This is the third time that the high court has punted on this issue. They did it previously in cases involving, I think, Wisconsin and Maryland. And now we have a case in state court awaiting a decision about the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering when it comes to the state's legislative districts. Why didn't the Supreme Court sidestepping of this issue, saying that courts have no place in this, neuter the issue?
Well, they punted the issue back down to the states. And so they thought that states could make the decision for their on their own if they wanted to limit partisan gerrymandering or just let the legislature decide. And it specifically pointed to some state courts that have taken up the issue. Also pointed out other ways and other avenues that states have to address it if they so choose.
So the case that we're talking about for the most of this hour is being heard in North Carolina State Court. And now that the Supreme Court has backed away from partisan gerrymandering on three occasions, effectively shutting the doors to federal courts for opponents of partisan gerrymandering, is this where opponents will be setting up shop in the state courts around the country?
It appears so. State constitutions are different or can be different from federal constitutions. So I think, whatever happens in North Carolina is going to kind of serve as a blueprint for other states. Mm. Of course, Pennsylvania and Florida have already limited partisan gerrymandering to some extent or made rulings related to partisan gerrymandering in their state Supreme Courts. I think we'll see more states across the nation making arguments under their state constitution to try to limit how much partisan politics is too much when it comes to redistricting.
I'm embarrassed to say this, but I've never read the North Carolina Constitution, so I don't know the answer to this question. I know there's nothing about political parties or specifically about gerrymandering in the United States Constitution. Is there anything in the state Constitution about parties or gerrymandering?
There's not, but I think, one of the main arguments in this partisan gerrymandering case has to do with a clause that we have about free and fair free elections. So the argument is that free elections means that North Carolinians should have free and fair elections and fair maps. Of course, there's also an argument to be made about equal equality when it comes to voting and that.
Okay. So Will Duran is here. He's with the Raleigh NNO. In this case that we're talking about, Common Cause versus Lewis, played out before a panel of three Superior Court judges who spent, I think, about two weeks listening to arguments. And former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr has said that state courts have the right and the responsibility to consider cases of partisan gerrymandering. We're still waiting on the court's decision, but if they decide that partisan gerrymandering of legislative district goes against the state constitution, would that have ramifications for partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts as well in North Carolina?
Well, I think it's probably a little too soon to say on that. Obviously, this case, like you mentioned, only deals with the state legislature. And it's possible that if the reform advocates get a win here, that they could then push to get new lines for the congressional districts as well. One thing to...
But, I mean, if partisan gerrymandering is determined to be unconstitutional for the drawing of legislative districts, why wouldn't that extend to all kinds of partisan gerrymandering instantly?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that you would hear lawyers making that exact same argument, and I'm sure that you would hear lawyers arguing against it.
Okay.
That's something that we've seen with these cases, is that there are so many nuances within the law that, you know, it's really feasible for people to argue both sides at length. Like you said, this trial we just had took 2 weeks.
And we've been talking about redistricting problems and redrawing and drawing again and drawing a third time various district voting lines for years in North Carolina. So take us back to the beginnings, at the risk of taking the rest of the show. Take us back to the beginnings of this instance of legislative redistricting. To the casual observer, it seems to me, the congressional redistricting by the legislature to help one party over the other seemed open and shut because Republicans admitted that they purposely disadvantaged Democrats, and it could have been worse except for the fact they couldn't figure out how to make it worse. So how does that compare to how they drew the legislative districts in question?
You've heard leadership say throughout the process that they don't believe that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. They think that the Supreme Court got it right in that federal case in declining to rule against it, they've said that, you know, yes, this is just kind of a fact of life. When a political party gets to draw the lines, it's obviously going to draw the lines to help itself, and it would be silly to think otherwise. And that's the way it's always happened in North Carolina when Democrats were in charge for many years. Now, mm-hmm. with Republicans in charge since 2011, they came in and were able to do the same. So that's kind of been their argument, is just that, you know, we think this is just a legislative prerogative, and it's not for the courts to step in and tell us that it's wrong.
So how long have these districts, the ones that are in question, how long have they been in place, and what has been the impact of how those districts were drawn?
Sure. So these lines were passed in 2017, so they were used in the 2018 elections, and depending on how this case goes, they may or may not be used in the 2020 elections as well. Really, a key statistic that the challengers in this lawsuit kept coming back to is, in the 2018 elections, Democratic candidates for those state legislative seats, 120 seats in the House, 50 seats in the Senate, Democratic candidates won the majority of the votes statewide, but did not win a majority of the seats. In fact, they did break the veto-proof supermajority that Republicans had in the legislature, but only just narrowly. And so they have kind of cited those lopsided statistics to prove
and the fact that Democrats won more than 50% of the vote throughout the state in legislative districts indicates that certain districts are packed in certain ways, so Democrats can have those districts, but not many of them. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and Republicans have countered that this has happened before, that parties have won a majority of the votes, but not a majority of the seats. And they also say that the Democrats just simply have a geography problem, that they're clustered in major urban areas like Charlotte and Raleigh, mm-hmm. Greensboro, and not as spread out around the state as Republican voters are, and just the way that, the lines are drawn to represent all corners of the state just tends to favor Republicans because they're a little more spread out than Democratic voters.
So, Melissa, is it truly possible, as Stanton Jones, who represents the plaintiffs in the case, said, that Democrats cannot win a majority in the state house? He went on to say that these plans are impervious to the will of the voters. Is he right?
There's no way of knowing until, you know, an election, I think. But, you know, one thing that I would note that came from the trial that the plaintiffs had mentioned was that these maps that were drawn by Dr. Thomas Hoffler, a well-known GOP map maker, you know, they contend that these maps were drawn very specifically to create two firewalls, one to protect the Republican supermajority and one to protect just the Republican majority. And so what we saw last year, which was considered by many to be a blue wave election, you know, the Democrats broke through the first firewall, which was to protect the Republican supermajority. But what Stanton Jones and what many of the experts talked about was how it would be impossible for the Democrats, without upward of 55% of the vote or so, to break through that second firewall, which is to protect the Republican majority.
But, you know, Democrat and I think former Speaker of the House, State House, Dan Blue, testified that when Democrats were in control, they gerrymandered in a way, quote, designed to give them a perpetual majority. Clearly, Republicans have found a way to win despite that, because they had the supermajority for several years and now they have a majority still. Is it possible the court could see that as a strong reason that they should not get involved, the fact that the Republicans were able to break through this perpetual majority that the Democrats designed, and that Democrats have been able to wrestle back the supermajority control?
It is possible that they could take that into consideration, but I think one of the main issues that's come up, both at the U.S. Supreme Court level and in this case, is that this is not gerrymandering from the past that we're seeing. You know, technology has really improved the process. So, you know, both sides have done it and both sides continue to do it across the nation, Democrats, Republicans. But what we're seeing is a real, you know, we can't predict what these computers are going to look like in the future, what software is going to look like, and it keeps getting better and better and better. And so it's really taken gerrymandering to a whole nother level. And that's the fear if this isn't addressed, is that it's going to continue to do that until we have just, you know, a free-for-all when it comes to drawing these districts, and whichever party is in control is going to be able to manipulate district lines in a way that, you know, we might not even be able to imagine right now because of how technology will continue to advance.
So Will, since the Democrats did exactly the same thing when they were in charge for 100 years that the Republicans are being accused of doing now that has damaged the Democrats, is it simply safe to say that this is really, it boils down to the fact that you can do it now with laser precision with computers, so it's all about intent?
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, Melissa made a really good point that, you know, because of computer technology having increased so much in the past few years, you can really just, you know, nail down to the individual, you know, neighborhood street level and figure out, okay, you know, this intersection has, you know, on this side it's more Republican, on this side it's more Democrat, so we'll end the line here.
Right. Will Durant is a political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Melissa Belton is a court and law reporter for the NC Policy Watch. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Melissa Belton, courts and law reporter for NC Policy Watch, and Will Durand, political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, about a trial that just recently ended that deals with partisan gerrymandering of legislative districts in North Carolina. It was heard by a three-judge panel that we're still waiting to hear a decision from, and it should be pointed out that these legislative districts are the same districts that had to be redrawn because a previous legislative map was ruled to be a racial gerrymander, which is unconstitutional. And so that we're trying to determine whether partisan gerrymandering is as well. Tell us about the three judges on this panel, Melissa, Paul Ridgway, Joseph Crosswhite, and Alma Hinton. What would previous decisions tell us, if anything, about how they might feel about this case?
Well, they are very well versed in redistricting. I mean, they've sat on prior redistricting hearings before, and they are very well attuned to what is going on. I don't have their decisions in front of me, but I can say that they understand what is being explained to them at a very high level. And we're talking about expert testimony, experts trying to decry other experts. So it's a lot of math and statistics and a lot of really complex issues that they're hearing, and they are following along, and they're right with what's being presented, and frequently would stop and say, you know, okay, I'm understanding it this way. Is this correct? And every time the attorneys were like, yes, you're understanding this exactly how it is. So, you know, not sure how they were ruled, but, you know, I think North Carolinians can be assured that they certainly will take this very seriously and make sure that they understand all of the nuances of the case. And whatever their decision is, it won't be something that is rash, that they're just kind of, you know, that they want to just get this on to the next court. I think they want to try to get this right.
They say that timing is everything, and the timing here is particularly crucial, it seems to me, Will, because the 2020 census is looming large, and the next legislature will have to redraw the districts to align them with the findings of the census. And if they rule that these districts have to go, then the Democrats will have a better shot over the next 10 years of taking back the legislature. If they don't rule in, if the ruling says that the legislative districts as drawn can stand, they will have a tougher time of it. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's hyperbole to say that what happens in the next, you know, 6 or 7 months here is really going to potentially define the next decade in North Carolina politics. You know, if the Democrats should win this case here and get new maps for the 2020 elections that are a little bit more favorable to them, say they end up winning the majority of the votes again in 2020 and actually win the majority of the seats, then they'll go into 2021 when, like you said, we'll be redrawing these districts for the next 10 years in charge, and it'll be Democrats again. And obviously, you know, then we'll see, you know, if they put their money where their mouth is and take politics completely out of it or partially out of it, or if they leave it a completely political process. But really, I mean, these 2020 elections, you know, people are focusing a lot on the presidential race, of course, but the state races are going to be huge because whether the Democrats or Republicans have control of the legislature after these 2020 elections will determine really the next 10 years of map drawing, both for the state legislature and for Congress.
So what happens if the court decides that partisan gerrymandering is in fact unconstitutional? That means these maps have to be drawn again. Who would do it? Would they let given the fact that the legislature has repeatedly redrawn these districts, would they be given yet another opportunity to do it, or would this go to an outside entity or something, a third party called a special master in some cases? Who would do this?
I think either of those options are on the table. You know, you would probably see both sides in the lawsuit try to, you know, get the chance to put forward their own maps. The courts would probably, it's probably likely, I would say, that if these maps were thrown out, the courts would give both sides a chance to submit a remedy, you know, a new map of their own. And if they didn't like either of those, then they would go with a special master. That's what we've seen in some previous cases where maps have been overturned as unconstitutional. They hire a professor from somewhere or some sort of expert who doesn't really have
a dog in the race.
Any reason to care about?
Well,
you know, state politics.
Would that be the case, Melissa, with this Hoffler guy, Tom Hoffler? He was a professor, wasn't he?
I'm not sure if he was a professor, actually.
Okay.
I know he you know, his bread and butter was drawing maps, and being consulted on map drawing. So I'm sure there are others out there who are just like him.
But he was a part. Would you characterize him as a partisan, or was he simply being partisan because he was getting his money from the Republican legislature? In other words, if it had been a Democratic legislature, would he have tried to pull the same stunt that he pulled here in favor of Democrats?
I think it's very possible, I would say that, you know, there had to be some partisan motivation there, because, you know, as a mapmaker of his caliber, at some point, you know, he had a choice with which party, you know, he would draw for, and, you know, he, you know, helped kind of this revolution, essentially, you know, what we've heard, it's called the Red Map Project, of getting Republicans put into state legislatures across the nation in 2010 by drawing these maps. So I think at some point there had to be an intent on his own, but also, you know, he was following very strict instruction from his from the people who were giving him his money.
Yeah. This was a lightning strike moment in this trial when these maps came to light. These were secret maps, if I'm not mistaken, or secret files that were found on Tom Hoeffler's computer by his daughter after he passed away. And for whatever reason, she decided to turn these over. How exactly did these files come to light? Because they were never supposed to see the light of day.
Sure. Yeah. His once Tom Hoeffler passed, his daughter brought them to the plaintiffs in this case and said that she wanted people to know what her father had been doing. And so, you know, of course, there was a very lengthy back and forth legal battle over whether or not these documents could be used or could not be used. Mm-hmm. You know, there are still, you know, what we saw at the trial, the maps that we saw, that is a very minute, very small picture compared to the documents that they actually have. And, you know, we're probably talking millions and millions of pages, over 76,000 documents, I think, in total. Mm-hmm. That legal battle is still ongoing in terms of whether the rest of the files can be used in this litigation and other litigation. And then once they were revealed, you know, it was, like you said, it was kind of a bombshell, or at least that's how the plaintiffs, I think the plaintiffs characterized it as smoking gun evidence, because, you know, they were able to see what Tom Hoeffler was seeing when he opened when he was working on his maps.
Well, it also went counter to the discovery of those maps revealed information that was counter to what somebody had testified to. And I believe that person's testimony was thrown out. Is that correct?
Yes. That was also a huge point turning point in the trial, because one of the contentions here is that the legislature lied to the federal court previously. And of course, the legislature has denied this. But, you know, they in particular told the federal court, you know, we haven't drawn these maps yet. We need more time, when the federal court was considering holding a special election in 2017 after the racial gerrymandering case. You know, they said, oh, no, we need more time. We haven't drawn these. And then what the plaintiff's experts found was that, you know, 95% of the Senate map had already been drawn by the time the public redistricting process had taken place, and that 90% of the House map had been drawn by the time the redistricting process took place. And this expert had presented an analysis that ran counter to that. And so, said, oh, no, these weren't drawn.
So that's why you write in one of your articles that this could open a pathway back to the federal courts. If it does open that door, if it does go back to the federal courts, what impact might this have?
So I think at this point, you know, if it were to open that pathway, it would just maybe look like sanction, sanctions to the legislature if it is found that they had lied. You know, election law very frequently only looks forward. It can't often look backward. And that's kind of how we end up in situations with delays and unconstitutional maps and why voters vote under unconstitutional maps for so long, because there's not a lot of remedy. But one thing I will note that will come from this that has already been talked about by the plaintiffs is that they're going to ask this court not to allow the legislature to have another chance to draw these maps because they've already violated that public trust that comes with it.
The three-judge panel considering this will is made up of two Democrats and one Republican. The state Supreme Court, this is very likely to go to the Supreme Court no matter which way this decision comes down. They have a 6-1 Democratic majority. Would there be any point for Republicans to appeal to the high court should they lose this time around?
Well, I think so. I mean, you talk to any judge and they'll tell you, usually very strenuously, that they make their decisions based on the law and not on politics. Some people are more cynical than others on whether or not that's true. But you did see in this case that the Republican legislative leaders tried to get this case out of state courts and move it into federal courts, specifically citing the partisan makeup of the state Supreme Court, saying that they didn't think that they would get a fair shake at the 6-1 Democratic Supreme Court. That move failed. Obviously, the federal courts didn't buy their reasons for trying to move it, and the case has remained in state court, where, like you said, it'll probably go to the Supreme Court. And we'll see. You know, maybe for some people this will be a test for the Supreme Court of, you know, whether or not this decision is going to come down on completely partisan lines or not.
So the trial is over. We're waiting a decision. When is that likely to come down, Will?
Oh, not for at least a week. I would say likely more than that. And that also, you know, gets to a point which, you know, the 2020 elections are coming up soon. March is the primaries. We're going to be quickly running out of time to draw new maps, if that's what the courts decide needs to happen.
And would they start drawing those maps based on whatever, if the court decides they have to be redrawn, would they start drawing those maps even though they plan an appeal?
It's possible.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Melissa does.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that they could start, but what's more likely to happen is that whatever decision comes down from this three-judge panel, either losing party will probably ask for a stay so that nothing happens until there's some sort of finality.
So we're going to turn our attention now to concerns over the integrity of the elections process. An accurate vote count is all important, obviously, in maintaining faith in democracy, but threats of Russian interference, as well as that of other actors, has amped up worries over accuracy and how to ensure it in our elections process. Now, the North Carolina Board of Elections has been looking at our voting systems, the kind of machines that we use, how the vote is recorded, and more. Melissa Boughton, courts and law reporter for NC Policy Watch, is still here along with Will Duran, politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. But we're going to be joined now for this discussion by Liz Howard. She is legal counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. Her work focuses on cybersecurity and elections. Liz, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are told that the Russians interfered in some way in all 50 states' election processes in the 2016 presidential election. What does that mean? Do we know what that means?
So based on the report recently issued about Russian interference by the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, it looks like DHS believes that all 50 states were probably scanned by the Russians, meaning that the Russians did some reconnaissance work to take a look at, to try to peer into our election infrastructure and, for instance, the voter registration databases that are used in every state across the country. So they were trying to obtain and gather information about the backbone of our election infrastructure and to see if we have any vulnerabilities or any weaknesses.
The Brennan Center for Justice, for whom you work, reported that Russian hackers compromised election software here in North Carolina. What did they do or attempt to do?
So in North Carolina, you know, the Senate intelligence report doesn't identify specific states, but what we do know was that in North Carolina, there are many counties that use electronic poll books that provided by a vendor called VR Systems. VR Systems has been identified as a vendor that was successfully attacked and infiltrated by a spear phishing campaign. So it looks as if there may have been some problems with the electronic poll books provided by that particular vendor in North Carolina.
And electronic poll books are the things that they, when you walk in to vote, you give them your name and address and they check you off as having come to vote. That's what you're talking about, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Electronic poll books are just kind of today's version of the paper poll books that many people are very familiar with. So it's just a list of everyone that's registered to vote at that particular polling location.
Do we know if anyone's results, if any results anywhere in North Carolina were compromised, or if anyone's vote got lost, or if anyone was not permitted to vote because the electronic poll books had been tampered with?
So, again, the Senate Intelligence Report indicates that they found no evidence of any tabulation problem. So they didn't find any evidence that the results of any election were interfered with in 2016. Obviously, in 2016, there were reports of various problems at polling locations related to concerns and problems with the electronic poll books.
We know that voting software in Durham County went haywire on Election Day in 2016. Looking back, could that have been because of this, these interference attempts by Russian hackers? Because these machines in Durham were made by VR Systems.
It's possible. The federal government is investigating that right now. The state had actually asked the feds to investigate that for a very long time and had gotten pushback. We saw, the Mueller report about it. There was more and more news articles, and finally the feds decided to actually come in and investigate. So that started earlier this late spring, early summer. And
we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that situation in Durham and about hacking in general into our voting system and just how secure they are, what's being done to make them more so when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
This week on FAQ City, a listener wonders what's at the top of the Bank of America Tower and how far can you see from there?
You can see out the full length windows, floor to ceiling. It's like taking a lobby and putting it up 60 floors.
We'll get an insider's view of the tower's 60th floor. Check us out wherever you get podcasts. Support for FAQ City comes from Bojangles Chicken and Biscuits and Tyndall Subaru.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about election security, voting security going forward for the rest of the hour with Liz Howard, legal counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. Will Duran is with us as well, politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Melissa Boughton, courts and law reporter for NC Policy Watch. Will, I want to get back to Durham County for just a second and not spend a lot of time on this, but VR Systems made the machines used in Durham County. Liz just spoke about how VR Systems was in fact breached, and it may have affected the voter registration, computerized voter registration books. You mentioned that the company was referred to in the Mueller report when they wrote of Russian spies successfully hacking into U.S. voting software in the last election. The Mueller report found that, quote, Russian cyber actors in 2016 targeted the company, VR Systems, and installed malware on the company network. What else do we know?
We don't know a lot.
Why not? Why don't we know a lot? Why don't we? It's been 2 years. This is serious stuff. Why don't we know more? Or does somebody know more? They're just not telling you.
Someone definitely knows more than me, but that's true about most things in life. the state's investigation was not able to really get to the bottom of this because state officials simply don't have the technical expertise and equipment required to really do what's called a cyber forensic analysis of this and figure out, for sure what exactly happened. They can't rule out that, that Russian hacking was to blame. They can't necessarily say that it was, but they can't rule it out. So that's why they had to get the federal investigators in to look at it. That investigation is still happening. we're not sure when that's going to wrap up. But
I mean, most of us don't understand how this works. I certainly don't. But if you're breaking into a system and somebody knows, Liz, that your system has been broken into, they must know that because some sort of breadcrumbs are being left behind. There's evidence of that?
So it will vary by the system, but one of the recommendations that the Intelligence Committee report states is that states should engage in a process to ensure that we have accurate backup voter registration data, including on occasion a printed paper backup. So in the event that there has been some sort of breach to a voter registration database, election officials will always have that paper to fall back on if necessary.
Here's a question. Years ago, actually before the last presidential election, we talked to a lot of elections experts, election board people from around the country, people who were very intimately, had an intimate understanding of computerized election systems. And almost to a person, they said, computers aren't safe for this. But they also said that none of these computers used in election systems touch the internet. That the real concern was in the coding of the system and in also making sure that what does touch the machines is clean and has not been compromised in any way. So I guess the question is, how did VR systems get breached? If things don't touch the internet, how did hackers get in?
So there are two different systems that we're talking about. The experts that you were talking to earlier were specifically talking about the voting machines, the machines that you and voters across the state of North Carolina use to indicate which candidates they are choosing on election day. VR Systems is a vendor for electronic poll books. So those are a separate system which collect and maintain the information about individual voters. I would say this, even though a machine is not connected to the internet, that does not equate to complete security. We, as you indicated, right, like what touches that machine also can impact its security. And, you know, there is widespread agreement, including from President Trump, that paper ballots are absolutely the way to go for your voting system. So with the electronic poll books, the information is a little bit different because the state, which has the state voter registration database, has to be able to distribute that and share that important information with local election officials who are responsible for administering elections and making decisions at the local level about which person is or isn't registered to vote. And that requires them to have access to the state voter registration database.
So here in North Carolina, it has already been decided, it was already decided several years ago, that the electronic ballot voting machines, including the touch screens that we use here in Mecklenburg County, would be replaced for the 2020 presidential election with paper ballots. That election is but a year away, Melissa, and now we understand we have a heightened need for this paper ballot and for tightly controlled election infrastructure and creating a paper trail. Why is the elections board still undecided about what they're going to do?
Well, you know, they're trying to, I think some of them would like to have stricter requirements for some of these voting machines. There's concern that the touchscreen systems are not as safe as the systems that just produce paper ballots. But I think the main concern is that with one machine in particular, it creates, when voters put in their choices on the ballot and they get handed a paper ballot to be tabulated. And what is on that paper ballot is a barcode. So the voter doesn't actually get to see or verify the choices that they made and before it gets tabulated. And so there's some concern that because they can't verify that, their vote might not be what they intended it to be.
Well, the idea that the paper trail would be imprinted with a barcode with all of your voting information is absurd on the face of it. I mean, if that would be easily hackable by anybody with a gamer could do that, it would seem to me. So the elections board has, they're talking about a stricter standard that would mandate that a voter must be able to identify his or her intent as evidenced by a mark on the ballot, something that needs to, that can be humanly read by a human being. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in Mecklenburg County, our voting machines, our touchscreen voting machines, as you press the screen for your vote, a little paper tape prints out, you know, president, candidate X, candidate Y, whatever you push, that paper tape prints. And you can look in a little window, most people probably don't, and see that you've voted for candidate X because it says so on the paper tape. Why isn't that sufficient?
So that paper tape is actually what's being phased out.
Why?
I think it also has to do with security and having that kind of physical paper trail, you know, as opposed to just the elections board keeping track of what's going on. And so they want something that does that paper ballot that shows the choices. But because of the security concerns, the DREs are being phased out. And that's why the systems have to be replaced, because they're no longer going to be using that voting receipt.
Liz, in your job with the Brennan, well, actually prior to your job, I believe, or maybe during your job with the Brennan Center, you have coordinated a lot of election administration modernization projects, including the decertification of all paperless voting systems and the implementation of e-motor voter programs and things like that. What do you see as the safest way to ensure the integrity of the vote going forward?
So absolutely, we need paper ballots. And just to go back to your previous question about the concerns with the current equipment used where they have the paper trail that you were referring to, technically we call it the Voter Verifiable Paper Audit Trail, a VVPAT. Mm-hmm. So those are collected, as Melissa said, on DREs. So DRE stands for Direct Recording Electronic Voting Equipment. So that means that your electronic vote is what is tabulated by the machine. The paper that you look at, the VVPAT, is not what is tabulated. So that's why those concerns, that's why there are security concerns attached with the DREs that have VVPADs. And I also would like to go back and talk about the systems that are currently up for certification, because my understanding is that one of the machines, as Melissa said, right, provides, it's a touchscreen, very similar to what Mecklenburg uses now, but instead of the vote being recorded electronically, the machine, the touchscreen, will print out a ballot, and that ballot card will include not just barcodes, but also a list of every candidate that you selected, and it will provide a voter an opportunity to verify that the printed ballot includes the candidates and only the candidates that they selected on the touchscreen. And then that voter would subsequently insert that paper ballot into a tabulator.
Ah, and there's the sticky wicket. Because even if we take a number two lead pencil and do like an SAT test and mark our ballot manually, or whether we use this touch screen that prints out what we've said we want to vote for, and we hand that piece of paper to somebody and they stick it in a machine and the machine reads it, what is to prevent the machine that reads the ballot from being insecure or changing our vote because somebody hacked it?
This is such a good question. So the essential election security bookend to actually using paper ballots is to conduct a post-election audit where you review the paper ballots by hand using only the human readable portion of that paper ballot. So you go back and you verify that the election outcomes that are generally the unofficial results generally come out on election night. And you want to go back and make sure that those are actually accurate.
So what we get on election night may or may not be the real result. You're saying that everybody in every state in the union on a presidential election, every voting district needs to go back and do a manual recount of every paper ballot, have a person look at everything on a piece of paper and mark it down? Is that what you're saying?
So, not quite. I'm suggesting an audit as opposed to a full recount. Okay. So, specifically in one of the election security measures noted in the Senate Intelligence Report is called a risk-limiting audit. And that allows us to use statistics to draw a sample size, like a small portion of the ballots that were cast, and look and actually, as you said, manually review those ballots, right, to provide us with some statistical assurance that the outcome announced on election night was indeed accurate.
So North Carolina's process of selecting how we're going to vote next time was slowed for a little while over concerns about who owned the companies who manufactured the machines that were under consideration. The board, the elections board, wanted those vying for certification to divulge everyone with a 5% or more stake in their company or any parent or subsidiary company. Is that happening elsewhere? Is that unreasonable? Because I'm told that there are manufacturers with big connections to one political party or another, and may have outside connections to a nation state, for instance, or an investor from a nation state.
So I think North Carolina is leading the way in insisting that voting equipment vendors provide that information. And I know that this is a question that many election officials across the country have. And I know that they have shared the information that has been provided to North Carolina. And there are many questions that I think that we need to ask voting equipment vendors, such as what cybersecurity practices are they using at their company? Do you do background checks on your employees? I think that, you know, regulating vendors is an important step in making our election systems more secure. And, you know, we certainly had concerns about voting equipment vendors and some electronic poll book vendors in the state of Virginia. And without, you know, requirements as to what their role is as we work together across this country to further strengthen our election infrastructure, you know, some of what the vendors have done historically is concerning.
Again, Will, time here is of the essence because the 2020 election is right around the corner, and the Elections Board has delayed a vote on what exactly they want to do on several occasions in just the last week or so. And, of course, the head of the Elections Board just resigned, effective immediately because of an improper joke that he told at a public setting. How is that impacting the speed with which we will get a decision on this?
There have certainly been lots of delays. Some were a little more expected than others. Like, I don't think anyone expected the chairman to tell a raunchy joke and then have to resign over it. But there's actually another vote today, Thursday, that I'm going to be going to right as soon as I get off this interview. So we'll see. Maybe there might be news just after this finishes airing. But yeah, it's really getting down to the wire. The Elections Board has been asking the state legislature to give them permission to delay this, because right now the machines that Mecklenburg County and some other counties around the state use are going to be decertified, not allowed to be used at the end of this year, at the end of 2019. And there is real concern by state officials that there's not going to be enough time to get new machines in place.
All right, I have 30 seconds left, Liz, and we have the federal government saying we've been hacked, the federal government coming out with recommendations, a lot of which have been redacted so that local officials can't even see what their recommendations are. Mitch McConnell refusing to bring this up for a vote in the Senate, election security. How concerned should we be in 15 seconds or less?
I think that North Carolina election officials have important steps to take, and they can take them before the March primary, and they can certainly replace their outdated and potentially vulnerable equipment.
Liz Howard is legal counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. Will Durand's with us, too, political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Melissa Boughton, court and law reporter for NC Policy Watch. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.